It's Tuned to Yesterday, broadcasting programs from radio's golden years. Mark Levenier, your host for this hour of true history. Later on, a story from the Cavalcade of America. But right now, a scathing review on Author Meets the Critics, a program that invited book critics to a panel to, exactly how it implies, meet the author. This one of the more acerbic broadcasts from NBC from July 4th, 1948, reviewing Russell Janney's book, The Miracle of the Bells.
Russell Janney, author of The Miracle of the Bells, meets critics Merle Miller and Father William C. Kernan on The Author Meets the Critics. Welcome to The Author Meets the Critics, the original radio program where outstanding authors are put to the severest test, meeting their critics face to face. Now meet the man who keeps the peace on these programs, your regular chairman, John K.M. McCaffrey.
Thank you, Bob Carey, and good afternoon, everyone. This afternoon, NBC is presenting The Author Meets the Critics for the first time on its coast-to-coast network. On these provocative, lively, free-for-all programs, you will hear literary critics taking potshots not only at best-selling books, but in the weeks to come, we'll present theater and movie critics attacking and defending outstanding Broadway plays and Hollywood movies. Are there any other kind of movies than Hollywood movies? In other words, playwrights and screenwriters, as well as novelists and historians, will receive their share of critical praise or censure as they come to grips here when The Author Meets the Critics. Now, this afternoon, we're concerned with The Miracle of the Bells, one of the leading bestsellers of the past few seasons. Over 500,000 copies have already been sold, and as you may know, Hollywood spent $3 million on a motion picture version with Frederick Murray, Valli, and Frank Sinatra. Author of The Miracle of the Bells is Russell Janney, famous producer of Broadway plays, including The Vagabond King. Now, Mr. Janney, you understand you are the victim this afternoon, and I trust you're prepared for, a stimulating discussion of your book?
Mr. McCaffrey, I know this program. Been on it twice before, and I'm prepared for anything.
We'll bring on the critics, and here they are. First, an editor of Harper's Magazine, former managing editor of Yank, author of the recent bestseller that winter, Mr. Merle Miller.
John, several months ago when I first read Mr. Janney's book, I said that I thought it was not the worst book I'd ever read. It was only the second worst. I added, I think, that its principal thesis seemed to me spurious and dangerous, that its characters were stereotypes, that it bore no more relation to literature than, say, Little Orphan Annie, that its tears were crocodile and glycerin, that the story was foolish and false, and that, above all, it bored me. Well, I, last week, had to reread The Miracle of the Bells, and I want to apologize. I've changed my mind. I think I was too kind. It seems to me that not since Pollyanna and Freckles has so little been sold to so many. And if we're speaking of miracles, and Mr. Janney speaks of miracles almost incessantly in this book, I want to point out that not only have I read the book twice, I have also, heaven help me, seen the movie. That is at least a minor miracle of endurance. It's a complete triumph, it seems to me, of matter over mind. At the moment, my head is not only bloody, it is also bowed.
Well, you see, ladies and gentlemen, that's what one critic thinks of The Miracle of the Bells. And what's more, Mr. Miller has the strength, courage, and nerve, take your choice, to tell it to the author to his face. That's what happens when the author meets the critics. Now, furthermore, Mr. Janney will strike back with full force in a little while. He's not afraid of Mr. Miller either. But before he does, hear now from another critic with another point of view, an outstanding Episcopalian clergyman, radio commentator, and executive director of the Institute for American Democracy, Father William C. Kernan.
Mr. Miller has a singular capacity for being able to read a book and not understand what's in it. Because the story he described to you is not the story which Mr. Janney wrote. The Miracle of the Bells is a story about faith and hope and love and the conquest of evil that men make when faith and love inspire them. Having read Mr. Miller's book that winter, not so far as I'm concerned, it's not.
Every mention, you know, Father Kernan.
Every mansion? No, not so far as I'm concerned, but having read his book, I doubt very much that Mr. Miller would be concerned considerably with faith or hope or love. But Mr. Janney is, And what he's written is a warm story, an exciting story. And when you finish this book, you say, life is worth living. If you failed, you say, I'll try again. And if you're already fighting a good fight, you say, I'm going on that way. That, Mr. Miller, is the miracle of the bells.
I thought the miracle was that I was able to read these 496 pages twice.
Well, you're thinking too much about yourself.
Well, before either one of you develop your own particular kinds of miracles, may I tell the one or two people in the United States who haven't read The Miracle of the Bells,
fortunate ones,
what the book is about. Now, The Miracle of the Bells is this. It all starts when Bill Dunnigan, theatrical press agent, walks into a burlesque rehearsal and sees an unhappy and awkward chorus girl. Something about the girl catches Dunnigan's fancy and sympathy. He pleads with the director, a friend of his, to give the kid a break. The girl, Olga Treskovna, a Polish girl who hails from a small mining town in Pennsylvania, never forgets this kindness, and Dunnigan never forgets the girl. Their paths cross again in Hollywood, and Dunnigan, an East Side slum boy with the instincts of a gentleman, once more seizes his chance to help the girl. When the star of the film has a knockdown, drag-out argument with the producer and leaves the studio flat, Dunnigan prevails upon the producer to give Olga a chance at the part. Olga makes good, but she dies in the effort before Dunnigan can declare his love for her. On her deathbed, she asks Dunnigan to take her body back to Coal Town and have the bells of the Church of St. Michael the Archangel rung at the funeral. Because of Olga's death, the producer refuses to release her film. The action moves swiftly then to Coal Town when Dunnigan, in charge of Olga's body, arrives to carry out the dead girl's wishes. Here he meets Father Paul, the ideal priest, the humble man of God. He prevails not only on Father Paul of St. Michael's to ring the bells, but on the other four churches of Coal Town as well, and to ring them not for a mere 15 minutes, but for 4 days running. This unprecedented bell ringing gets into the news. It becomes a national event. Reporters and newsreel men crowd Coal Town. The name of the hitherto obscure Olga Treskovna overnight attains celebrity. With all this publicity, which so astute a press agent as Dunnigan takes good care to increase, Harris, the producer, has a change of mind and decides to revive the film which stars Olga. In the course of the novel, a transformation takes place. The mining community of Coal Town is transformed from spiritual poverty to gladness and brotherhood. Tolerance and goodwill spring up between people, and it becomes a beautiful world, all because of Bill Dunnigan and the dead girl, Olga Treskovna. And this whole miracle occurs within the brief space of 4 days. And that's the story of The Miracle of the Bells. Now, from the gladness and brotherhood of The Miracle of the Bells, shall we go to the malice and general mayhem which characterizes The Author Meets the Critics. Father Kernan and Mr. Miller, Mr. Janney's body and the body of his book is yours for a few minutes. Father?
Well, I'd like to agree with one thing that Father Kernan said. He said that the author's intentions and the book's intentions were very noble. And I agree, they certainly are. But as a man of the cloth, I assume, Father, you know the road to what is paved with good intentions.
Yeah,
and
I know.
The paving is all there, but they're not. It's optimistic. It is an optimistic book. As I turned each page, I thought the next one has got to be better. Heaven knows it couldn't be any worse. But I was wrong, I'm afraid.
Well, I tell you, Mr. Miller, you're just talking and saying nothing. Now, when you come right down to it, what this book says is this. Here is a man, Dunnigan, who is an ace press agent, and he has been licked in this life. He's discouraged, and he hates the world, and he says, as a matter of fact, in substance, that he'd just as soon be out of it as in it, which is an expression, obviously, which animates a great many people facing life, people who are discouraged.
The church in which I believe is founded, I hoped and still believe, on a pillar of rot, not on a pillar of half-truths, not on a pillar of Hollywood publicity, of Batten, Barton, Durston, and Osborne, and ads in the Saturday Evening Post, not on Technicolor movies. I don't like this kind of philosophy.
Somewhere there's something about a pillar of salt, isn't there, Father? But go ahead. I don't mean to rub any salt in any wounds you may have occurred to you in that time.
Well, I'd like to have Father Kernan defend this thesis of not telling the people the truth because the light will go out of their eyes.
Well, I think perhaps another person should defend that thesis, Mr. Miller. I think that perhaps our author, Russell Janney, is in the best position to defend his own book. Mr. Janney, Mr. Russell Janney.
Right at first, Mr. Miller has not at all described what I wrote in the book about the miracle.
You mean I'll have to read it a third time, Mr.
You'll have
Jenny?
To read it a third time, I'm afraid. Bill Dunnigan sincerely believes that a miracle has happened. He says this. He says, your statues have been here for 40 years. Why haven't they turned before? Why did this movement of the earth happen at this particular time? Who are you, Father Paul, to say or not to say that this is or is not a miracle? That is what I wrote in the book, not that Father Paul went up and tried to hoodwink his congregation. To get off that, it seems to me that this whole debate is just a little bit absurd. I'm a theatrical producer, and to me, it's as if I had a play running for 2 years on Broadway, and then suddenly we had a debate as to whether that play was a good play or not. Now, The Miracle of the Bells has practically been running for 2 years. The life of the average bestseller, so booksellers tell me, is 3 months.
This is something, Mr. Jenny, I wouldn't want to dispute.
I have something else to say as regards that. I will say this, that I know very well that the mere fact that a book is a bestseller does not necessarily make it a good book. I will admit that. But what has pleased me about The Miracle of the Bells is not that I've been lucky enough and that it has sold over 500,000 copies and all that sort of thing. What has pleased me is that I have received, to date, it has now reached the point over 10,000 letters. I still get about 50 a day. And these letters are from people of all faiths and from no faith at all. And what these letters tell me is that my story has given them a new faith and a new hope and a new courage. And I think that in a troubled time such as we are having now, maybe that is something to have done. Also, I have had hundreds of letters saying a simple line like this: thank you, Mr. Janney, for writing a clean book about decent people. I didn't write The Miracle of the Bells for the present crop of so-called sophisticated literary critics. My hero of The Miracle of the Bells is not a drunkard. He's not a dope fiend. He's not a rapist. My heroine is not rushing from boudoir to boudoir with a different boyfriend in every chapter.
That's the difference, you know, between your book and Mr. Miller's.
Yeah.
I can now see thousands of people rushing to the bookstores. It only cost $3.
Don't fool yourself. You got off the bestseller list mighty fast, my friend. I watched it.
Well, I couldn't even find that Mr. Miller's book was on the bestseller list.
It was.
In fact, I went out I sent my man out to get his book on Saturday. The first two bookstores my man told me that he went to, they had never even heard of it. You should take that up with your publishers, Mr. Miller.
Mr. Johnny, luckily...
We finally did find a copy of it.
Luckily, Mr. Johnny, I didn't have that
people
trouble.
People were hiding
your publishers
it under the bed.
Gave me your book.
You couldn't find it, Mr. Johnny. The people were hiding it under the bed, the way they do at the back part of these Sixth Avenue bookstores in New York, you know?
Well, what I object to books, I haven't read your book yet, Mr. Miller, so I shouldn't criticize it, but what I...
Oh, don't let that stand in your way. It hasn't of anybody else on the program.
Certainly, if you're referring to me, it hasn't, Mr. Miller.
Well, let's talk about Mr. Janney's book. This is very, very...
I wanted to give poor Mr. Miller a plug when I found out that a couple of the biggest bookstores in New York had never even heard of him. I thought the poor guy needed a bit of help, and I'm glad to do it if I can. What I object to in the present crop of novels is that the writers take sordid characters, put them in sordid situations, and make out that that is typical of the American scene. I can tell you this. I have talked since this book came out with practically every large bookseller in America. I have to make trips for my theater business, and I've gone in and talked with the bookstores. And even the hard-boiled booksellers are fed up with that kind of books. It is that kind of book that has so damaged the book publishing business that the whole business is now at a low ebb, so I am told.
Well, Mr. Miller, how do you feel about the low ebb of the publishing business and these criticisms of your book, but how do they stand up as defenses of Mr. Janney's book?
Well, Mr. Janney is apparently talking about a book that somebody else wrote. I'm not sure which one it is. To me, the climax of his book, I think, is the funeral. It's a big thing. Here in this little mining community in Pennsylvania come, 50 or 100 movie stars, come 100 boy choristers, come people from all over the country, the governor of the state, legislators, congressmen, etc. It's a great spiritual moment, it says there in the book. To me, it was about as spiritual as, well, Lana Turner's wedding a couple of weeks ago, although I did think the wedding of Lana Turner was in slightly better taste. You see, my objection to the book is that I think the basic philosophy is wrong, is a little obscene, and I don't think the spiritual quality is there. I think
that's
it's a
That's pretty
phony
good
quality.
For you to talk about something being obscene. Ho, ho.
Well, I would like to bring up a question which I feel...
Well, you couldn't read
point,
that book of yours
I,
on the radio, Mr. All Miller.
All I could say is obscene worse. At any rate, one thing that we might introduce into this conversation is a discussion of the bringing of faith to a lot of people. Mr. Janney has said we live in troubled times, and certainly we do. And one of the defenses and one of the virtues of his own book, which he has brought to our attention, is that through this book, a lot of people have either revived their faith or found new faith. I wonder if it isn't a pertinent question to ask if the bases on which people find their faith are not as important as finding the faith itself. Obviously, a faith which is unsatisfactory, obviously, a faith which will not really be a bulwark against our times, it would be better not to have it than to have something which is going to collapse. Do you want to comment on that, Father Cunan?
Why, of course. Surely people have got to have faith. If people will not have faith in God, and if they will not direct their faith and hope and love toward him and toward his creatures, they will have faith in somebody like Stalin or like Hitler. People have got to have faith in somebody, and people always have to worship something or someone. And what this book is saying is, being written in a Christian spirit, that these people are inspired by the love of God, and they believe that the supernatural world impinges upon this one, as a matter of fact, impregnates it, and in the person of Jesus Christ actually invaded it. And consequently, they say all of life has been changed, and it can be redeemed, and it can be redeemed. And a lot of these authors, like Mr. Miller, who go around dragging humanity down into the gutter constantly, are people whom I say I consider to be a disservice to this country at a time like this, but more than that, a disservice to the human race.
I should just like to point out, however, Father Cunan, that the Redeemer himself found many of his subjects in the gutter, but Mr. Miller...
But he raised them. He raised them if they had faith in them. He constantly said, go in peace, thy faith hath saved thee. Of course he found them in the gutter. People are in the gutter. That's life. But life is also raising the people out of the gutter.
I couldn't agree more with much of what Father Cunan has said. Well, of course we want people to have faith, but what kind of faith? And founded on what? Founded on a lie? Founded on a half-truth? I don't think so.
Of course, that's
For
not
example,
what the book says.
It seems to me that the thesis of the book is that if somehow Steve Hannigan had brought three bathing beauties to the Sermon on the Mount, it would have made the front page of the New York Daily Mirror instead of the religious section. This kind of faith I'm against. I think the Sermon on the Mount is one of the great pieces of literature, one of the great pieces of faith, but I think it's
very
honest.
Very condescending of you, sir. Very condescending.
Could we get back, Father Cunan, to whether or not this is an honest kind
yes,
of faith?
Yes, I'll go on you with that. You bet I will. The book, first of all, isn't about the turning of the statues. That is a minor consideration. The book says very plainly this. Here is a man, Dunnigan, who, because of a great and good and pure love for this girl, and because a kindly and humble parish priest has courage under difficulties, suddenly comes to light, and all of his life is energized, and it begins to operate around a great central principle. And as a result of that, things begin to happen in that town. One of the things that happens, but it's only an incident, it amounts to nothing compared with the changed lives of the numerous people there, as a matter of fact,
look,
of
Father,
all the people.
Look, Father, in many ways, Mr. Miller is saying that the end does not justify the means. Granted that we all agree, everyone here at this table agrees that the ends of the miracle of the bells were fine.
Mr. Miller's objection is that he doesn't think that bad means will ever achieve good ends.
Is that right,
Mr. Miller?
Oh, exactly. Or that a bad novel will ever achieve good means.
But I deny categorically that the means in this book are bad. Dunnigan is not doing this as a publicity stunt. That's what the movie made him do. The movie's a turkey. It's no good whatsoever, but it's not this book. What Mr. Janney made Dunnigan do in this book was this: to use such talents as he had in the service of God. You are familiar with the story of
the
Tumbler
of Notre Dame.
I
know exactly what you're going to say.
Well, all right. All Dunnigan could use were the talents that he had. He had no other talents except those of a great publicity man, and he used them. Now, there's nothing wrong with that, and he didn't use them insincerely.
You know,
he used them because he believed in what he was doing.
Mr. Miller.
Father Conan, my favorite piece of literary criticism, I'm sure you won't agree either with the piece of criticism or with the critic, is that of Mr. George Bernard Shaw. We were talking a lot about moral books versus immoral books. It was Mr. Shaw, I think, who said, there is no such thing as a moral or an immoral book. There are books that are badly written, and there are books that are well written, and that's all. Well, if that's the test, I'm afraid, and I think that's a good test, I'm afraid I must put Mr. Janney's book down as a badly written book.
Oh, well, now you're changing your ground, and it's not going to do you any good to quote Mr. Shaw. Who agrees with Mr. Shaw? Everybody? I would not agree with Mr. Shaw on that matter.
Well, let's say that I would partially, Mr. Just
well,
to make
I wouldn't
a
agree
vote
with
of one
you.
Here. I would partially agree with Mr. Shaw. I think he was making a point.
Oh, yes.
I was hoping we wouldn't discuss the movie, but since Father Conan has brought it up, I'd
well,
like
why
to...
why discuss it since we're discussing Mr. Russell Janney's
well,
book?
Quite,
let's get back
frankly,
to that.
Well, Mr. Miller, as I told you before this program, I did not like the movie, so you
well,
can't get
well,
into
we
an
met.
Argument with me about
we have
that.
Now,
Mr. Janney, you and Father Conan like the book, and Mr. Miller doesn't like the book, so let's talk about the book. That makes everything much simpler then, doesn't it?
You don't want us to agree, do you?
Huh? No, certainly not. That's not my function, Father Conan. You know me of old. Mr. Janney, you must have further remarks to make about Mr. Miller's idea of
well,
your book.
Well, I really don't see where these very young people get off to call themselves infallible arbiters of what is fine writing and what is not fine writing. It may absolutely amaze Mr. Miller that I was asked to go to Columbia University and talk to the writing class at Columbia University by the head of the writing department there. I counted them yesterday at my office, 10 letters from the heads of 10 English departments of universities praising my style and my writing. Of course, it's not to be expected if you do something differently, if you do something very positive, that everyone will like it. No writer expects that. But there have been many more people who liked it, apparently, than who did
not like it.
And we have, by the way, Mr. Miller said the book bored him. Now, we have a motto in the theater, and I don't claim to be anything except a theatrical man. We have a motto in the theater, thou shalt not bore. And I have literally had hundreds of letters from readers saying, when I started to read the book, I could not put it down. Apparently, although I bored Mr. Miller, I have not bored thousands of readers in America.
Well, Mr. Janney, I could put the book down all right. I did have a little trouble because of its bulk picking it up, but not too much. Incidentally, about Columbia, I don't think that proves very much. I talked at Columbia, too.
Look, gentlemen, let me say at this point that I once taught in a college, and I think they've regretted it ever since. I mean, every college can make a mistake.
John, about this matter of age that Mr. Janney and Father Conan have brought up, I'm reminded of that wonderful story by Hans Christian Andersen. You know the one about the king's clothes?
A tailor
comes along and makes some clothes for the king. They're so light, they're so fine that nobody can see them. And finally, a child, again, out of the mouths of babes, finally a child looks at the king and says, by the way, he's nude. Well, when I finished
you'd
reading...
You'd notice that, all right. You'd notice
book,
it.
Mr. Miller is making a point. We've had an awful lot of argumentum ad hominem on this. Let's let him make his point with his story.
Well, the main point of the story, it seems to me, falls back on what to me are the worst aspects of our civilization. It's advertising agencies, it's Hollywood, it's spurious movies, it's ads in the Saturday Evening Post, and etc. I think there are genuine miracles. I don't think the miracles in this book are genuine. I think the only thing that I got out of the book, and perhaps this is lacking in me, I've only read it twice, is that every press agent has a silver lining, and I don't believe it.
Well, let's take up something else in this. Of course, there's no use in rehashing the answer to Mr. Miller's argument. He keeps on one string there. Of course, that's characteristic. In his book, he harped on one string, too. Won't tell you which one.
I'm a little confused about which book is being talked about.
Mr. Miller's book. Mr. Miller harps on one string, and I won't tell you which one. But now, let's consider something else in this book. He says it's the worst aspect of American life which is portrayed here. Well, you know, I don't agree with that. I notice in this book that there's a very fine spirit between the Catholics, the Protestants, and the Jews in it. And the book ends by Mr. Janney expressing this sentiment, "Thank God this is America," meaning that this is a country in which every man's right to worship God, whether he be a Catholic or a Protestant or a Jew, is recognized, where we're free from persecution on that score, at least in principle and very largely in practice. I think that that is not a bad aspect in American life. I think that that's an aspect of our life which is exceedingly to be admired and one to be encouraged. And there's a very great deal of it in Mr. Janney's book. Marcus Harris, the movie producer, is Jewish. Dunnigan is Irish, and at least
a Catholic.
And you have all of the people in Coal Town, or the greater majority of them, are Catholics and Polish. And you find constantly in this book a fine rapport and spirit of comradeship among these people. That's a part of the book, too. Something that Mr. Miller, I think, has not chosen to mention.
Well, I was very fond, Father Kernan, of Mr. Marcus, the producer.
I think, Mr. Miller, I can only allow you to say that you were fond of Mr. Marcus,
of,
and I'm glad you were, because the time is up for both the author and the critics. Now, before closing, I'd like to thank Mr. Russell Janney for coming here today to discuss the miracle of the bells, and to thank you, Father Kernan and Merle Miller, for joining us. This is John McCaffrey saying good afternoon. Until next week at the same time for The Author Meets the Critics.
Author Meets the Critics on Tuned to Yesterday from July 4th, 1948 on NBC. The movie adaptation of The Miracle of the Bells referenced in that last broadcast starred Fred McMurray, Alida Valli, who you might remember from The Third Man, Lee J. Cobb, and Frank Sinatra, even with an all-star cast failing to impress some of the critics on that panel. You're listening to an hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. And now the story of Joseph Pulitzer on the Cavalcade of America called Page One. This first turn on NBC on May 12th, 1947.
The Cavalcade of America, starring John Hodiak. Tonight, the DuPont Company brings you Page One, starring John Hodiak on the Cavalcade of America. And now, Page One, starring John Hodiak as Joseph Pulitzer on the Cavalcade of America.
Mister?
What? What do you want, lad?
I'd like to ask you a question, please.
Be quick about it, then. I'm busy.
How soon will we be docking?
In the morning.
Morning? But I must get ashore now.
That's so? Well, lad, there's only one way to do it, and you'll get wet trying it.
One way? Thank you.
Huh? Hey, stop! Come back here, you crazy kid! Stop back here! Stop!
The young fool jumped overboard. He's swimming for the shore.
That was 1864. The lad who was so eager to get to America enlisted immediately in the Union Army to fight for the country he had come to as an immigrant, 17 years old, eager. For 1 year he fought. Then, the war over, Joseph Pulitzer walked the streets with other discharged soldiers seeking a job.
Excuse me.
Yeah?
My name is Joseph Pulitzer. I've been in America a year. I heard that this is where they are hiring men to go to Louisiana.
You heard right.
What kind of work is there in Louisiana?
Plantation work.
How would I get there?
See that man over there?
Won the seaman's cap?
Yes.
For $5, he'll take you down on his boat.
Oh, $5.
$5 too much for you?
5 cents would be too much.
Not bad, huh?
I have no money, but I want to work.
Well, do what I did. Sell your overcoat. There's a place down the street they'll pay $5 for it. Well,
good. In Louisiana, I won't need it anyway.
All right, men. Line up one at a time. Pay your passage money at the desk up front. $5 ahead. All aboard for Louisiana, the land of opportunity. Make good money on the plantations. Get 100 times your $5 back again.
Can you wait for me?
Huh? Well, sure. Anything to oblige, son. How long would you like me to wait? Until you take care of your family estate and settle your affairs?
No, just until I run down the street to sell my overcoat to get the $5.
Well, now, that's different. And tell you what, son, just to show you my heart's in the right place, I'll take your coat and you can hop right aboard. How's that?
Here it is, and thank you very much.
How long do we gotta wait here for the other boat to pick us up?
The captain said not more than a couple of hours, Ed.
Look, Joe, it's been over that now. There's something fishy about this.
But he explained. He told us that he would take us as far as this levee, then another boat would pick us up.
Yeah, I heard him. But where's the other boat?
Wait a minute. Here comes somebody now. Everything will be all right.
Hiya, man.
Oh, hiya. What's going on here?
Where's the boat?
Boat? What are you talking about?
Well, there was to be a boat to take us the rest of the way to Louisiana.
Oh, so that's the game. Well, son, you're barely outside of St. Louis.
Yes, we know that. You're not from the boat?
No, I'm a reporter from the newspaper in town. Yeah, we got wind of this crowd here, and I nosed out to see what's going on.
Oh. Well, each of us paid $5 for passage to Louisiana to get jobs there. The captain of the boat we were on put us ashore here.
Just like that, huh?
Yes.
Well, I hate to bust up your tour, son, but... No boat stop here. Something tells me you men were taken in by a slicker.
You're sure of that?
Of course. This isn't the first time.
Then we're just stranded here?
I'm afraid so.
By the dirty thieving dogs. And each of us a veteran. The dirty crooks. That's what we get for trusting people. That's what we get for risking our necks. Look, I say let's go back into town and look up those crooks and beat them up and hang them.
No,
wait. Wait.
Would that do us any good?
Yeah. It'll do my soul a lot of good.
You're wrong, Ed. Very wrong.
What are you so high and mighty about? You sold your coat and for what? You risked your neck in the war and for what? It's no good, Joe, and you know it.
Please, listen to me. Most of you were born right here in America. I wasn't. It hasn't been more than a year ago that I jumped from a ship to fight for the country that I've come to love.
That's a lot of rot.
No, it's not. Ed, we were swindled, yes, but we mustn't look at the men who swindled us as being America. There are good and bad in every country.
Show me the good in this.
I can't do that because there is no good in it. But you said we were veterans. Each of us fought to save the Union. Well, why should we have fought just a short time ago to preserve it and now be willing to become a mob and destroy part of it because one man had wronged us? America is much bigger than those little men, Ed, much bigger than we are. If we want to fight against wrong and evil, let us fight with the greatest weapon we have, our own democracy. I'm sorry. That was a speech. I hate speeches.
What's your name, son?
Joseph Pulitzer.
Look, do you think you could put those words on paper?
You mean write them?
Mm-hmm, for my paper. My boss is Carl Schurz.
Carl Schurz? General Carl Schurz?
Yes.
Well, he was my old army commander.
Well, good. Come on, then. You write that the way you said it, and we'll see what can be done about this business.
This is good, Pulitzer. Very good.
And you'll do something about the swindle, Mr. Schurz?
And more. I'll give you a job right now.
Mr. Schurz, I've got a story on that closed political meeting.
You what? You got in there?
Yes. Is it funny?
You got in where every other reporter on my paper failed.
Well, Joe Pulitzer, demon reporter, the boy wonder. Tell us your secret, Joe.
Well, I guess...
He's got no secret. And all of you listen to me. From now on, don't kid Pulitzer. Copy him.
Young man. Young man.
Hmm?
You.
Oh, I beg your pardon, ma'am. I didn't know you were talking to me.
Well, I am. Must you eat that apple in the library?
Oh, I'm sorry. Was it disturbing you?
I've never heard a noisier apple.
Joseph. Joseph.
Oh, hello, Udo.
Joseph, you are my dear friend, yes?
I am your dear friend. You are my dear friend.
Then I beg you, stop eating apples in the library where I am in charge, huh?
Well, do you want me to take my apples to another one?
Please, don't joke. Do you want me to lose my job?
Of course not, Udo. I'll stop.
Yeah, and one more thing. I cannot let you stay in the library anymore after closing hours.
But I have so little time to read all these books.
In the morning, I have to rush my breakfast, sometimes even forget my coffee to keep you from freezing to death on the steps outside. And at night, I'm late going home because I cannot get you out of here.
Udo, a man is allotted only 24 hours a day. That's little enough to read all the books I have to read.
Yeah, that is another thing. Law books. Why should a promising journalist like you read law books?
Udo, if I wanted to become a doctor, what would I read?
Doctor books? But...
I read law books. Therefore, I want to become a lawyer.
You are crazy. With a career such as you have in store in the newspaper business, you want to give it up for law.
That's right.
Oh, it will take such a long time. Waste of time.
I don't think so, Udo.
You are crazy. You should not do it. You...
Udo. Udo, listen to me a moment.
Why? Why should I listen to foolishness?
It's not foolish. You see, America has given me the opportunity to become what I want to be. So, I'm going to study law and earn my way by being a journalist until I am a lawyer. Now, where else in the world could I study for one thing while earning my living in another? Only in America, Udo. Only in America.
Udo! Udo!
Shh!
Joseph, why must you always wake these people up?
Where can we talk?
Talk? Come behind the section on civic government. No one ever uses those books. I thought you were in Washington, Joseph.
I'm back.
Yeah, I know. So does everyone else in here.
It's wonderful, Udo. Wonderful. She's wonderful.
Who? Where?
Her name is Kate Davis. She's the most charming. She's the most... Udo, there aren't enough books in this library to describe her, to do her credit.
Yeah. If you had read something beside law books, you would know.
Udo, I'm going to get married.
Ah? Huh?
Yes.
Good. Now I will be able to close the library once in a while.
You don't seem enthusiastic about it.
Oh, but I am, Joseph. I hope you will be very happy.
It would be impossible to be otherwise with her.
I'm glad for you.
We're going to Europe on our honeymoon. And when we come back, I'm going to become a lawyer.
That again. Joseph, I will talk to her. I will tell her to keep you from doing that.
You can try, but my mind's made up. But I don't want to talk about that. I want to talk about her, about Kate. Wait till you see her. You'll fall in love with her too, Udo.
Foolishness, foolishness. I thought when you came back from your honeymoon, you would not remember this lawyer business, Joseph.
Udo, more than ever, my mind's made up. Now listen, don't tell Kate, but I've picked out my offices. I want them to be a surprise for her.
Bah.
Joseph Pulitzer, attorney at law.
Joseph Pulitzer, fish out of water. It's like Kate says, you are a newspaper man and already famous. You will smother on the briefs, appeals.
The only way I could be happy in the newspaper business is to have my own paper. And there are too many in St. Louis right now. No, it would mean skimping, saving. I don't want Kate to go through that.
I have met her. She would do it, Joseph.
I know that. And that's exactly the reason I'm going into law. Kate would do anything if she thought it would help me and...
Yeah? And what?
What's that crowd in front of the courthouse?
I don't know.
Cabby! Cabby, drive over to the courthouse.
Oh, it is not trouble. The crowd is orderly.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, I have been authorized to put up for sale the press, property, and physical assets of the defunct St. Louis Dispatch.
Udo, the dispatch is being auctioned.
Just another paper gum broke.
Come, ladies and gentlemen, surely we can get an opening bid.
Let's see who bids.
What do I hear? What's the opening bid?
$1,000.
That was Mr. Alexander. $1, he's no fool.
We'd better go, huh?
Who
Let's see who gets
true?
It.
Who bid 2,000?
2,000.
2,000 from Mr.
That
Grayson.
That was Mr. Grayson. He's no fool either.
Who'll make it 3,000?
$2,500.
Huh?
$2,500.
What did I do?
What you always wanted to do, Joseph.
Maybe someone else will bid 3,000. If anyone says three, I'll keep my mouth closed.
Will someone say 3,000? Mr. Alexander, Mr. Grayson, will you say three?
Why doesn't someone say something?
All right. Going once, going twice, going three times, and sold to Mr. Joseph Pulitzer for $2,500.
Oh, Udo, I didn't mean that. Why did I do it? I want to be a lawyer.
Yeah, sure. So you bought a newspaper. You wanted to be a lawyer so badly that you...
All right, you win.
But what'll Kate say?
Kate? Oh, she knows you, Joseph. Kate will say good.
All right. I've bought a newspaper. But I've bought something else, Udo. I've bought responsibility and a duty to the people. Very well. I'll make it the best newspaper I can.
Having purchased the St. Louis Dispatch at an auction and merged with the Post, another St. Louis newspaper, Joseph Pulitzer determines to make his paper the finest possible. In his office, he is reading an editorial he has just dictated.
And the Post-Dispatch will continue its fight against corruption, vice, and all the shameful practices so prevalent. That sound all right, John?
Well, it's a little strong, J.P. You see, before the merger, the Post always...
This is the Post-Dispatch now, John.
Yes, but the people you write these editorials about are... Well, they won't take it lying down.
The people depend upon the freedom of the press. It's part and parcel of our democracy. And when a newspaper fails to do its duty, when it fails to use its freedom, it may as well go out of business. What time is it, John?
Almost midnight.
Midnight?
Mm-hmm.
Kate will be worried. I didn't know it was that late. Where's my hat?
Right here.
Thanks. And don't set that editorial up yet. I may want to add more to it. Good night.
Good night, J.P.
Cab. Cabby.
Sorry, sir. This is taken.
Oh.
Hey. Hey there.
Yes, are you talking to me?
You. Say, you're Joseph Pulitzer, ain't you?
Yes, I am.
I thought so. It's him, Mike.
Let's go.
Hey, what? Oh, yeah. Let go of me. What are you trying to do?
Maybe you'll go easy after this, Mr. J.P. See how you like it.
Stop this.
Joseph?
Oh, Udo. What time is it?
4:00.
Afternoon?
Yeah.
Will you tell Mark to get the carriage? 3 days in bed are enough. A few little bruises and scratches.
A few bruises and scratches? It was more than that. The doctor says you were a lucky man.
Poppycock, I've got to get back to the paper.
The doctor said...
All I've got are these headaches. They'll go away in a few weeks, maybe days.
Joseph, you are leaving for New York next week.
New York, but I...
And from New York, you are leaving for Europe, and you are not coming back until you are better.
Udo. Udo, you in here?
Yeah, Joseph. Now, have you checked the passports? You have seen to the tickets?
Yes.
Why do you say it like that?
Oh, I ran into Jay Gould. Great financier, but a little out of step as a publisher.
Turn you loose for a half hour in New York and you run right into the newspaper business. Mm.
You know, Udo, that newspaper of Gould's, the New York World... It's not in bad shape physically, but as a paper, it's a little run down.
Why don't you look at me when you talk?
Hmm?
Joseph, what did you do?
I bought the New York World.
You bought, but you were supposed to rest to go to Europe.
Not now, later.
Your help is...
Fine. But Kate, what will Kate say?
I know.
Do you think she'll be angry, Udo?
Kate angry? No. She will smile and unpack.
John! John!
You called me, J.P.?
Yes, I did. Did you check this story?
The World printed it. It's true.
And it's a shame. A crying, miserable shame.
Well, J.P.,
I... The Statue of Liberty lying in the marshes of France, John. Bought by the people of France for this country, and Congress won't appropriate money for a pedestal.
Well, no one can do anything about that.
The world can. The world will make Congress see that...
Yes?
No. Not Congress. John, I'll write to the real strength of America.
I don't understand.
Look out the window. There's the real strength of America, the people.
But what about them? What can they do?
Listen. The people of France, tradesmen, laborers, children, paid $250,000 to have Bartoli make that statue, and the people of America will buy the pedestal for it.
Been driving yourself night and day, writing editorials, reading letters from contributors, answering them.
It's got to be done.
Yeah. But Kate is worried, very worried.
This'll all be over in a little while.
Why don't you let someone else do it?
Someone else? Wait. Miss Stevens. Miss Stevens.
Yes, sir.
Bring those letters in, please.
Right away, Miss Fullerton.
You'll see why I can't let someone else do it, Udo.
But you're not well, Joseph.
I'm just tired.
The letters, Mr. Pulitzer.
Thank you. Don't go, Miss Stevens. Sit down. Now, Udo, pick one of those letters. Anyone. Now read it.
Wait, I will turn out the light.
No. The light hurts my eyes. Can you read in this light, Miss Stevens?
I think so, Mr. Pulitzer.
The light hurts your eyes? Joseph, you've got to see a doctor.
Never mind that now. Go ahead, Miss Stevens. Read that letter.
To the world, New York, New York. Enclosed, you will please to find 15 cents to help buy the pedestal for the Statue of Liberty. I know 15 cents is not much, but maybe it will help some. Yours truly, Edward Rizik.
15 cents. Udo, it was probably money he could have used for food, anything but this.
It is wonderful.
Take another, Miss Stevens. Anyone.
Dear World Newspaper, I am 7 years old. Here's 3 cents, for which kindly accept my contribution to the pedestal for the statue from France. My mother will give me some Sunday money tomorrow, and I will send that to you also, too. It is...
The people, Udo. The people. It's their country. Their liberty.
Joseph, wonderful.
The Statue of Liberty.
Congratulations, J.P. It's a great thing, a great thing.
Thank you. Udo.
Yeah?
Tell me, what does it look like?
What does what look like?
The statue.
Well, you know, you saw it unveiled.
No, I didn't see anything.
You didn't see?
I suddenly felt as though there was a deep fog. Then it was dark. Very dark, Udo.
Oh, Joseph, I will get Kate.
No. I want to tell her myself.
Such tragedy.
Tragedy? No. Oh, I won't pretend that it's nothing at all, but thank God I've been allowed to go this far. I didn't have to see that statue, Udo. What it stands for, no man can see, unless he loves liberty. And I saw that. Now, let's go home.
Yeah, Joseph.
Udo, I want you to promise me something.
Of course. Anything.
I've had a dream, my friend. And Kate and you must help me see it come to realization. A school for journalism.
A school?
Yes. Yes, a school. We'll endow it with the necessary funds. Butler of Columbia University has already consented. We'll have traveling scholarships for young students. And, Udo, we'll have a special gold medal award for outstanding contributions to the American press. What do you think of that?
It
It is splendid, Joseph.
And there'll be other prizes for drama, music, cash prizes, but for the press, to inspire the men who will write the news, there must be that special award. Oh, Udo, there's so much to do. So much to do.
And, oh, my friend Joseph.
Here, none of that. Come on, Udo, let's go. I've got lots of work to do.
And Joseph Pulitzer's dream came true. Each year, the Pulitzer Prize for Journalism epitomizes the craftsmanship and brilliance of the American press and the men who write the news. Men who remember Joseph Pulitzer's creed.
Our republic and its press will rise or fall together. Only an able, disinterested, public-spirited press with a trained intelligence to know the right and the courage to do it can preserve that public virtue without which popular government is a sham and a mockery.
The Cavalcade of America, on Tuned to Yesterday from the 12th of May, 1947 on NBC, bringing to a close this hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's past. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark LeVonier. Thanks for listening.